The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and on this week, we are minding our G's and our Q's. The super-fast mobile broadband 4G spectrum is under the microscope, and wait for it, Guardian Games correspondent Keith Stewart interviews intrepid veteran video games designer American McGee. You see that? I'm so sorry. That was a really bad joke. Joining me in the studio to groan and roll their eyes at the other terrible jokes that I'll be making over the next half an hour are Keith Stewart himself and technology editor Charles Arthur. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. And Keith, you're going to be going to the Electronics Entertainment Expo.
Yes,
next week, E3 as it's known, in Los Angeles. We're going to be hearing more about that later on. But if you had to pick one thing, possibly the most ridiculous thing, not any like the big headlines, you know, Nintendo's going to announce or is Microsoft going to announce, of the things that you're going to see in LA,
booth
what
babes?
Would it be? Yeah. Will there be booth
babes? I don't look. I shield my eyes as I walk past. Okay. Disgusted.
I'm a married potato.
Yeah.
I'm a married sperm.
I would say, well, IndieCade. Every year I like to go to IndieCade because it's this small section of E3 which just looks like a games programmer's bedroom. Lots of ancient PCs and new PCs on desks with lots of fizzy pop everywhere, and lots of scruffy people sitting around trying to show off their amazing games. So I head there every year straight away.
When I was at the Tokyo Game Show several years ago, I think my favorite bit was the indie showcase, and it was ridiculous. There was one game that was about broccoli. I just thought that's exactly what we're looking for in this world. That's missing from the market.
There's no way enough games about green vegetables.
Certainly not. And it wasn't even an educational game. It was dancing broccoli. You know, it was awesome. We're also joined by Ben Room, who's from Nokia Siemens Networks. Now, Ben, you're gonna be helping us pick apart the future of broadband access in the UK. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much.
Are you a gamer?
I am a gamer. Well, I say I'm a gamer. Actually, I tend to buy consoles depending on a really sort of big signature game coming out. So I bought an Xbox 360 because Rockstar Games came out with Red Dead Redemption. So I was a big fan of that, and I've always been a big fan of Rockstar Games. So I tend to sit back, see what other people, see what the experts make of the games, and bide my time. And then, you know, maybe if we have another child and there's a lot of sleepless nights, I'll be spending those midnight hours playing a bit of gaming.
Yeah, so I need to have children in order to rekindle my interest in computer
games. That's exactly
the reason. We can lend you some.
No, it's fine. Yeah. Thanks. I'm busy enough with my cat. Well, yes, anyway, for the rest of the podcast, we'll be looking at this week's news from around the web. So keep listening to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Los Angeles is already well known for its colorful characters, but for one week of the year, every year, the Southern Californian city goes even more technicolor as the world's games industry descends on the Convention Center for the Electronic Entertainment Expo, colloquially known as E3. After a brief hiatus a few years ago, it's reemerged as the highlight of the games calendar, a full-on consumer event where the biggest announcements from the biggest players are made. This year, all eyes are focused on Sony, Microsoft, and Nintendo to see what these companies have planned for the next generation of gaming. Keith, I think the biggest question now is what will happen with Sony? They recently had an enormous pile-up, a big media conflagration to do with their PlayStation Network and the loss of several hundreds of thousands of account holders' account details. And they really haven't been doing much, I must say, when it comes to the consumer products. They seem to be floundering after being the market leader for more than a decade. So what do you think is going to happen at E3 with Sony?
Yeah, it's been an ambiguous time for Sony. I'll put it like that. I'm sure that's probably how their PR people would do it. I mean, PlayStation 3 has actually done reasonably well recently. It's since the price drop a couple of years ago, since the new slim design, numbers have been increasing. They've been gaining ground on the other machines. So in a lot of ways, they're doing well. They've got decent first party games. You know, things like Uncharted are doing extremely well for them. quite aside from the problems that they've had with the network, PSP Go, which was their optical disc-free version of the Sony PSP handheld console, didn't do very well and sort of quietly gone into a corner and dropped dead.
But they're actually intending to announce something about their new PSP.
Well, they've announced that they're making the Sony NGP handheld console, which is going to be a follow-up to the PSP, which has got lots of interesting features. And it looks like there's lots of rumours that it's going to be called Vita. It's got a touch screen and behind the screen on the base of it, which brings up lots of interesting things they might be able to do with sort of touch and feeling in games. Because often the problem with touchscreen games is you have to put your fingers in the way and it gets in the way of the screen.
How much would you say that they are responding to the mobile gaming scene? You know, things like the Apple iPhone really has had quite an immense effect on how we interact with our technologies. So how much, you know, are games responding to this kind of thing?
A lot. I mean, Sony have got this two-pronged approach, really, to portable games now. They've got their Sony Xperia Play mobile phone handset, which they feel, I suspect, is going after the Apple section. It's an Android handset which plays early PlayStation games. They see, I think, Sony NGP is more of a sort of a handheld for their hardcore audience. But even in this machine, there's certain looks towards the mobile, the smartphone sector, because it's going to have connectivity, it's going to have a quad-core ARM processor, which is the same sort of technology which is now in the high-end smartphones. So they're definitely looking towards that space, but they're cutting up their own market, really, with these sort of two different concepts, and it's going to be interesting how that works.
Isn't there a problem with them sort of chopping it up like this? I mean, the Apple approach has the benefit of simplicity, which is you have an iPhone or you have an iPod Touch. They can both run the same sorts of games. So kids who don't get an iPhone can get an iPod Touch. You know, it's not that much more expensive. It costs about the same as PSP. And the games are all modern games. You know, they're not sort of old, cast-off, you know, aging PlayStation games, which seems to be the model for the Xperia.
You're completely right. I think the thing to remember about Xperia Play is it's also a very good Android gaming handset. And lots of the key developers are optimizing their games to make use of the Xperia Play controller, which is actually very good. I don't think it's not the best Android handset out there, but it's good for gamers. But I think you're right, splitting their key user base into two groups, hardcore and mainstream, could be a problem for Sony.
It's not just Sony that are talking about new hardware with their next PlayStation. Nintendo are also talking about something in the future. What's that?
I think Nintendo is going to be the big... although Sony's of interest to us as news people, but I really do think the big thing for consumers and for the games press this year is going to be Nintendo showing off their Wii successor, which at the moment is codenamed Project Cafe. It seems as though from speaking to developers who aren't really supposed to be talking about it but always do... it sounds like that the key thing with it is the hardware is going to be roughly the same power as an Xbox, but it's going to come with a controller which looks like a tablet PC, but with like a control stick and buttons, but also a big, I think probably about 8-inch LCD touchscreen display as well. So the idea is that you'll have these kind of two different ways of interacting with games, either through joypads or through a touch display.
It just sounds like the Dreamcast all over again.
But what happens to Wii Sports? How do you play your tennis game?
Well, you could probably take it with you on the go, exactly the same way that you could with your Dreamcast.
I think the idea they're trying to tap into is this whole idea of everybody having multiple screens in their living room now. So, you know, apparently we all sit there watching television, we all have tablet PCs on our laps, and we're used to that kind of multifunctionality. But one thing it will do is that you'll be able to play your games apparently on your TV, and if someone comes into the room and says, oh, I want to watch something on television, you can then transport that game experience onto the small screen. So there's this idea of games experience being passed around different screens. There's other things it's going to be able to do as well. It's going to have a front-facing camera, so there's going to be some motion control elements there. But yeah, I mean, no one knows quite what they're going to do with this technology, but that seems to be the direction they're going.
Given that the progress of computing seems to be that your devices can do more and more and more, how long is sort of games seem to be in this separate channel where you have gaming systems developed for gaming, whereas our mobile phones are developed to take photos and do gaming as well and lots of other things? I mean, and you walk into a room and screens can do multiple things, isn't too far off anyway. Do you think games are going to continue to have this kind of leading edge area where they're purely developing whole systems just to do gaming, or it'll become much more integrated?
Yeah, that is a question that the whole industry is facing at the moment. I think there is always going to be room for dedicated games consoles for a certain audience of people. But I think as we get into a situation now where we have, this year manufacturers are bringing out smart TVs with processors built in. You know, a lot of televisions these days that are coming out of the Far East have got ARM processors built in. And they have app stores and people will be able to play simple games. But I think there's always going to be an audience for really big epic games that you couldn't download. I mean, you couldn't download and play, you know, L.A. Noire or Red Dead Redemption. They're enormous games. And I think cloud computing is going to have to come on a hell of a lot before you can play games like that over the wire. So
you mentioned motion control, which is an aspect of the Microsoft Kinect. What's going to be happening with Kinect? What's going to be happening with the next Microsoft machine?
Yeah, Microsoft haven't. There's been no whispers about a major hardware launch from Microsoft so far. A few game sites have said, could Microsoft sort of come out and make an enormous announcement about Xbox 720, as it's been euphemistically termed? But I've not heard anything from developers, which leads me to believe that if they are going to announce anything, it won't be out for a couple of years because obviously dev kits aren't out there. Mm. I think the big thing really that Microsoft's going to be doing is going to be pushing Kinect and pushing Kinect as a proper hardcore gaming peripheral, because the first batch of games that we saw last year were all multi-sport games, dancing games, just family games that Wii has been doing for years and years and years. And what they've got to do is try and develop Kinect into something which is a serious proposition for gamers. And one of the games that may well be featured this year is the Star Wars Kinect game, in which you get to pretend to be holding a lightsaber and fighting people. And if anything's going to go down well at E3, then pretending to hold a lightsaber is probably it.
Well, speaking of what's going to go down well at E3, it's not just about the hardware. You mentioned earlier Indiecade. You mentioned some of the other things that are going to be happening at E3. So we've got the major players, we've got the major publishers, and then do we actually have a presence for indies? Is the Apple event that's happening at the same time going to have an effect on what's going on at E3? Are people going to be looking around at different business models? What's the kind of vibe that's going to be happening culturally at E3?
I think E3 is very much, the majority of E3 is about the big blockbuster AAA releases. But there is room there. Last year, Indiecade were there in force. Several, developers have been taken on from Indiecade over the last few years to work on major projects. Also, one of the big buzz games that was there last year was Limbo, which is a really small Xbox Live Arcade game created by a European developer. Very, very strange, monochrome, black and white adventure game. But it picked up a lot of interest there. And what we're finding now, to a certain extent, is that the big publishers like Microsoft and Sony are using independent games to sort of give themselves a bit of cachet, a bit of credibility. And the big publishers are doing this as well. EA is taking on a lot of indie developers and bringing out their games on Xbox Live Arcade. So it's a way of getting a little bit of cachet with hardcore gamers. And it's working really well. And I think there's a thriving independent scene, and it does have a place in E3, but a small place.
It's an interesting sort of Disney Miramax style business system that we're starting to see.
Exactly,
trickling down.
It's just like Fox Searchlight, it's the same idea. You encourage independent creativity and you'll reap the rewards.
I certainly hope so. Now, what are some of the big titles that are going to be coming out?
Well, it's masses and masses of sequels. The key thing is going to be Modern Warfare 3 versus Battlefield 3, which
Things not leaving
the room. It's got Hollywooditis, hasn't it?
I mean, it's been like this for a decade, Charles. I can't remember the last time that I saw something original.
But this is exactly what Hollywood is in. Is it's all making sequels, and the generally sequels get sort of less return than the original. Although it has to be said that as we speak, Hangover 2 is doing better than the original did. So not always the rule.
But Kung Fu Panda 2 isn't doing as
bad. So perhaps they cancel each other out. But I mean, do sequels work better in games than they do in films?
They tend to, because sequels do actually generally tend to be better in games than they do in films. You don't have that kind of creative vacuum where people are thinking, oh my God, we've got to do the same thing again. In some ways, because the technology improves, and because it's so much more based around technology and gameplay than story, you don't have that same kind of ennui where you know, script writers think, oh Christ, we've got to do the same thing again. Games are very different in that way. So, you know, the later games in the series tend to be much better.
So you mentioned Battlefield 3 and Modern Warfare 3. What other games are we looking for? Just some names.
Okay, I think the new Tomb Raider game looks really interesting, which has gone back into the past.
Oh, for God's sake, games industry.
Lara Croft is now collecting her bus pass.
She's 18.
Is that right? I can only imagine the booth babes there. But yes, no, so Tomb Raider.
Well, actually, there's an interesting game coming out of Japan called El Shaddai, Ascension of the Metatron, which almost no one will have heard of. It's an original game by a really interesting design team out in Japan. And that has done really, really well in Japan. It's a very strange kind of cartoonish, anime-ish fighting adventure, which is unlike lots of other stuff. So there's an original game. That's one to look out for. Unfortunately, the name is a bit unwieldy. I dread to mention anything else because they've all got numbers after them.
Well, Alice. American McGee's,
yes.
Alice 2.
That's a sequel.
We can accept that. It's the sort of he's the sort of Tim Burton of the games industry.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. That's a sequel, but it looks really interesting. And I met up with American McGee recently to ask him how he got involved with Alice, the game.
Well, when the original idea came to me, I certainly was a fan of and aware of the books, but the publisher that I was working for at the time, which was Electronic Arts, had asked me to come up with an original game concept and wanted something that they felt would fit with the image that I had in the industry at that time, which was sort of dark, violent, having come out of the Doom and Quake games. And so I was riding along the car in California along the Pacific Coast Highway, and the song came on in which the word wonder was mentioned alongside the word dark. And somehow this triggered an epiphany wait a second, I think something quite heavy and interesting could be done with a very dark wonderland.
Okay. We're on to the second game now. I think in the first game, Alice is... she's having sort of psychoanalysis, isn't she? She's gone through a trauma in your game, and what's happened? How have things changed for the sequel? What's Alice's story now?
Well, in the first game, what was happening was that she was using Wonderland as a tool to explore her own, you know, sort of mental landscape and to overcome the emotions that had come out of this tragic event in which her parents and family had died in this fire. In the second game, she's free of the asylum, but not necessarily free of the past. So she's still having to sort of wrestle with the demons and try to figure out, this time around, really not just how to deal with the repercussions, but also the question of how this fire happened. So in effect, this is a murder mystery, and it's one in which we're not very clear yet, you know, as to who might be culpable. Is it Alice herself? Were there some third parties involved, or was it nothing at all? And meanwhile, you know, the backdrop of this is Alice in a reality which is the streets of London, but also that sort of blending together with the madness that's still kind of chasing after her. So later sections in the game, you start to kind of question whether or not reality even exists for her, and if she's in fact left the asylum or not. So it's quite a twisted story that we've created for her.
Yeah, it's interesting that you, for both games, you've played with, as Lewis Carroll did, with the concepts of reality and non-reality and fantasy and the sort of interplay between the two. Mm-hmm. Is that, in a way, for you as well, a kind of comment on game design? Because game design is, you are immersed in this world, but you're also separate from this world.
Yeah, absolutely. We've intentionally layered in quite a lot of content. It's sort of self-referential to the process of creation of a reality, which is in fact what game creation is. And so it's interesting to look at it from the perspective of Alice as a sort of, let's call her a living, breathing character, being presented via a medium, which is some recreation of her reality, but then another layer inside of that, which is Wonderland. And so when you take those themes, what it comes back out to, for me anyway, was this idea of having to separate the idea of reality from fiction and also madness from sanity, because the question of whether or not you're mad or not oftentimes has to do with the existence that you're living inside of.
You really do have that interplay of the sort of the creepy and the sweet, which in a lot of Victorian literature can sort of interplay with each other. And you've really captured that, which is really interesting. I mean, was that a key for you, again, sort of explore that sort of liminal zone between sweetness and Darkness.
Well, you know, one of the rules that we created for the creation process in the product was that everything that we saw had to be a function of something that Alice would have experienced in her real life. So, in a sense, everything has to be very true to her as a character because this is her psychological landscape. So anytime that we do something creepy, it has to be not gory for the sake of gory or bloody for the sake of bloody, but something that we could realistically imagine she would have imagined by virtue of the experiences she's had in her life. And so a lot of times what you do end up with when you have that as your palette is that you can't just kind of push the blood button all the time. You need to find other ways to combine together the elements that she's been exposed to in her life to create something that's, you know, dissonant, that's something that's a juxtaposition that makes people uncomfortable.
One thing that really struck me about the first game, it was extraordinarily popular with female gamers. Mm-hmm. And I think there was much, much more to it than the simple, obvious fact that it was a female lead character. I think there were kind of elements in the story, and also it had this sense of magic realism about it, which I think maybe appealed there. I mean, what do you think? Did you spot that it was really, really popular with female gamers? And if so, why do you think that was?
Well, we did, and you know, one of the things I like to think is that it's not necessarily that she's a strong female character, but instead she's just a very strong human character. We didn't go out of our way to sort of cast her as what would, you know, be traditionally considered your typical sort of female video game character, which in fact they just become a sort of vehicle for an idealized body type or something like that. So, you know, what we did was, I think, create a character who, by virtue of her having come from the original Carol fiction, had a foundation and a sort of reality, but then we created a schism, a fracture within her by introducing the concept of her family having died. And this, I think, that blend did something that people could recognize, people could empathize with as another human being. And I think that's really where the strength came from.
And do you, going forward, do you see a further adventures for Alice?
The core concept of the first game was that she overcame the psychological landscape and she became the master of that domain. One of the core messages in the second game is that she connects that with becoming a master over the physical domain. And were we to do another product, I think there's a very interesting opportunity to see a character who now has control over both of these aspects of her personality and her reality, and can then use that to do some pretty interesting things on the streets of London during that era. Won't go beyond that with it, but I think that by the end of this game, she becomes a veritable superhero. And so there's quite a lot of interesting things that she could do after this.
Do you ever wonder what Lewis Carroll would have made of it? Do you think he would have been an author or a game designer in this era?
I think that actually he probably would have been a phenomenal video game designer because he was so experimental. He was so out there and so willing to kind of be surreal and push boundaries and not necessarily have to make sense all the time. And I think that's something that gaming and just, you know, media in general oftentimes lacks, is the willingness to go beyond and to do something for the sake of having fun with it, as opposed to having to see that, you know, somebody's necessarily going to understand it.
American McGee with Keith. And we'll be hearing from Keith next week from the show floor. Godspeed, Keith. may you have great resilience in
I'm
the face of
I'm not
going to
tell you about anything I see there.
I'm looking forward to hearing it.
I'm a married spud.
Now, here's Jemima with the news.
The UK military is developing a toolbox of offensive as well as defensive cyber weapons, The Guardian revealed this week, as it tries to counter a growing threat to national security from cyberspace. The UK was prompted to accelerate its cyber weapons programme by the Stuxnet virus, which successfully disrupted Iran's uranium enrichment programme. A Scottish grandmother has been sentenced to 3 years probation for illegal music sharing after admitting accessing £54,000 worth of content on a file-sharing site. Anne Muir, who suffers from depression, was investigated by police following a tip-off from the BPI. Twitter is widely expected to launch its own photo-sharing service at the D9 conference this week. Twitter, which has recently moved to take more control of third-party services, may power the service using Twimage.com, which it acquired last July. Apple has confirmed that Steve Jobs will attend its Worldwide Developer Conference next week to reveal both iOS 5, its latest mobile operating system, as well as Lion, the 8th version of Mac OS. There's no further news on whether Apple might reveal the iPhone 5 or a refreshed MacBook Air.
Thanks, Jemima. More tech news all week at guardian.co.uk/technology. This September, BT Wholesale and Everything Everywhere, which is the company that runs Orange and T-Mobile's joint mobile broadband access, will begin trials of their super-fast 4G LTE broadband services. 200 residents of St. Newlyn East near Newquay in Cornwall will be testing the live service. 100 fixed-line customers and 100 mobile customers will receive free combined mobile and fixed-line broadband until early next year, as the companies begin to roll out the next generation of mobile connectivity. Nokia Siemens Networks, and I'm going to quote here, invents, build, and run the world's most efficient and innovative telecom networks for service providers all over the world. And that's what you said, Ben, in an interview for another website. Well, you did, because
okay.
I pulled
okay.
it. But there, you are providing supporting technology for the trial. What technology actually are you implementing?
So for this particular trial, just as we do all over the world, we're providing what's technically known as an E-Node B. So in very simple language, a base station. So what you might see on top of a building, an antenna, and the software and hardware that runs the antenna to give somebody the connection, the wireless connection between their device and the operator's network, in this case Everything Everywhere and BT.
Is there anything special that needs to be put into place for a 4G network?
Actually, the current generation of base stations that we provide run 2G, 3G, 4G. They need a bit of a software upgrade if you've got our latest 3G base station, but that's essentially it. The hardware is all the same. The intelligence now in radio networks is in the software.
Take me back, right?
Okay.
What are the different Gs, right? 1G, 2G, 3G, 4G. So tell me just briefly, what are they? Give me a quick history.
Okay, 1G, analog mobile communication system. So anything pre-1990, 1991, think of the first generation mobile communication technology.
Smoke signals type of thing.
Yeah, and analog in the sense that, you know, you could tell how good or bad the reception was, not because you either had somebody speaking or not, but they kind of went fuzzy and like you would tune a radio. 2G, 20 years ago, that is a digital communication system which uses a binary signal. Then 3G came along, and there's a number of different 3G technologies. In a sense, there's sort of...
Didn't we have 2.5G in the middle there?
Well,
there's 2.5G. I mean, there's lots of different gradations. I mean, granular do we want to go?
Let's not go there. So 3G.
So 3G was the
now.
Big improvement. With 3G was... Voice was great with 2G. And essentially, actually, most of us still use 2G for our voice services. Even if you've got a 3G handset, it's more often than not carried on 2G. That's going to slowly start to change because we're going to reuse 2G spectrum to carry 3G signals. But 3G was more about giving people access to mobile data, so increasing the kind of number of bits of information you could get over the mobile sort of system.
Now, for each of these, I know that there are different standards.
Yep.
Right? And the 4G standards are LTE and WiMAX. What are the differences, and which one are you guys involved with?
So, well, I'm going to be a real pedant, actually, and you'll have plenty of pedants, I'm sure, who listen to this podcast. Originally, when the ITU defined 4G, they actually said for something
the
to be absolute...
International Telecoms Union.
International Telecoms Union, sorry. They set some criteria by which the only actual sort of current technology that's in development that would satisfy 4G was something called LTE Advanced.
LTE stands for long-term
evolution. Long-term evolution. Since then, they have recanted somewhat, I think partly under pressure from certain operators who are rolling out technologies sufficiently beyond 3G that, in experiential terms, what you receive feels like a next generation beyond 3G. For example, you have T-Mobile in the USA providing HSPA Plus, which gives really high data rates, in the hundreds of megabits per second downlink speeds.
And what is WiMAX? How does that compare then with the LTE?
The difference between the LTE we'll be using over here in Europe is that to get duplex, so in radio terms, duplex means if you want to do both receive and send information at the same time, you need two kind of channels. And there are a couple of ways of doing that with LTE. You can divide your channels up time-wise, time division duplex, TDD, or you can divide it up in terms of spectrum, frequency division. So you have a different channel and you can send and receive at the same time. Now, WiMAX essentially uses a time division variant It's reasonably similar, actually, to Time Division Duplex LTE, and why lots of operators now we're seeing moving from WiMAX, which was like an earlier version of 4G or mobile broadband, to TD-LTE. And the reason they're doing that is that you're likely to see more devices use both flavors of LTE rather than try and have a device that could roam on a WiMAX network and also go onto a long-term evolution network. So WiMAX was a good kind of, I think, a bit more of an interim 4G technology, if you like, good for fixed wireless access. And in your introduction, when you talked about this trial down in Cornwall, you talked about 100 fixed line customers and 100 mobile customers. We should make clear those fixed line customers are getting a wireless connection. It's not fixed line in the sense of a copper line coming to your house, obviously.
The fixed is the person using it rather than the actual.
Exactly.
So as a 4G customer,
yes,
right, how is my world going to be revolution? Am I going to be on turbo speed?
You need to ask the people of St. Newlyn East in September to December. I think one of the reasons this trial is happening is lots of operators all over the world, and this wasn't unique to the UK, were criticized because you saw these big headline figures for 3G about the mobile broadband that everybody would get, and some people were disappointed.
A lot of people were disappointed. I think it'd be fair to say. You
know. Now, I would argue, actually, that's not because 3G doesn't deliver very good speeds. It does. I mean, Ofcom released a study last week where the average of 4.3 million tests they conducted on the 3G networks in the UK were giving an average downlink speed of 1.5 megabits per second, which is pretty fast, actually.
Exactly. It's like sort of if you want to go back to the analog days, or even right. If you went back to dial-up after you've been using broadband, you would recognize just how fast we're moving.
So it's good, but the what people I think confuse with broadband and the difference between fixed and mobile broadband essentially at the moment is the speed stuff happens. So when your device, you want to call up a web page in your mobile, the network needs to do a lot of signaling to allocate you an IP address, to check where you are, know the base station it's going to send the information to, and then boom, you get a connection. And when it sort of ceases doing that, the connection kind of goes away again. And when you want to do something else, it takes time to go up. So again, that same Ofcom study, they were looking at latency for users who were doing this of about 8 seconds, right? So kind of pressing something and you being delivered with it. The big difference is that low latency. So latency is just that round trip speed between you asking for something and it being delivered to you. And actually, I think that's where it links with the first segment of the program. I've played mobile gaming on LTE networks, and you can genuinely do it. You're talking about sub 5-10 millisecond ping times for reactions on the network, and that's the biggest difference, I would say.
But isn't that latency also a bit dependent on? Okay, so you have to have smart software in the cell towers, but also you need the high speed backhaul from those cell towers to the core network. You need to have the high speed fiber doing the job there. And one would have to say that there's always a question in the UK of, well, is that high quality backhaul there? Because BT seems a little reluctant, you know, even though it's involved in this trial, BT has all sorts of issues about, well, this fiber stuff is, you know, very expensive for us to put in, really. And where's the benefit?
I think there's a myth about fiber. Most backhaul is actually done via microwave. So essentially another wireless technology, a kind of a much more focused kind of high bandwidth radio transmission that is like fiber and offers similar bandwidth. How these networks are constructed in their architecture in the core makes a huge difference to that latency and that speed. And if you talk in network terms, a flatter architecture in LTE, it's not just about the radio interface. It's that the whole way the network is set up to be run and managed is thinner. So it's all IP, for example, and that's the first time we'll have a radio network that's all IP. So it's IP from your handset all the way into the core of the network, to the cloud, to the internet, and back again. I mean, obviously, there's different network layers, but that means that there are simpler routes. The management of that's far simpler, and that's what affects things like the latency and the speed of connection people will get.
And that will obviously be a benefit for people who, for example, don't have immediate broadband access, or for whom super high speed broadband hasn't reached them. You mentioned that the trials that you're doing in Germany
they're commercial networks. So they've been running commercial networks over there in what they call, or they get called in the industry, rural white spots. So a white spot being an area which has just no broadband access at all. no fixed or anything.
And what are the intentions, if you know, given the success of this trial, will this immediately come to London, which has already got pretty good broadband access, in, so, you know, so depending upon where you are, or will it go out to the Highlands in Scotland? Yeah, how will this roll out?
Well, I'm a big believer that it's a huge driver of economies and society having this broadband connectivity. We had the debate in Parliament a couple of weeks ago, sponsored by Rory Stewart, the Tory MP, about broadband access and trying to impose on Ofcom, when they auction this spectrum that's going to become commercially available next May, that the coverage requirements of operators who buy it would be greater, I think about 98% of the country instead of 95%, because I certainly view it, and we would view it in the company, as really being the only technology that can genuinely offer this universal access to broadband. Now, this trial in Cornwall, I think the aim of that is to see, does it really offer an alternative to fixed broadband access that you might expect to get in your home? I think on average in the UK, Ofcom have said fixed broadband sends to be about 6.4 megabits per second, and they did the 3G mobile broadband was about 1.6. So can this 4G technology actually beat the current fixed mobile broadband and offer a solution for people who live in areas that are poorly served by the copper infrastructure?
Do you think then that when the auction comes up next May, that there'll be a big scramble for this 4G auction space, or will it just be, you know, left on the shelf?
I don't think it'll be left on the shelf. We've seen huge demand on it. I think one of the fears from Ofcom is if they impose greater coverage requirements on the operators, then they're likely to get less money from it. That's the argument they would use against doing that. But I think for the greater good of our economy and the country, we don't have brilliant consumer infrastructure in terms of broadband in this country. And I think if we're enlightened in a way, controversial here, in the countries that are really leading in this space and make the most of their information infrastructure, they tend to have beauty contests for spectrum. They don't sort of charge for it. We've gone down the charging for it route, but hopefully it won't be sort of completely market driven just on the spectrum side, so that when we're all having to pay in years to come for something, which I think is becoming a universal sort of right. It's amazing how much people value this communication.
Now, if you're in Cornwall, where can you find out more and sign up?
So the website to go to is, and I need to get this absolutely bang on, 4G, that's the number four, 4G wireless broadband trial.co.uk.
That's a nice, easy, parsimonious web address. But, you know, it
by
does
the 30th
what it says
of
in the
June.
Thin.
So by the 30th of June, sorry.
Ben Room, thank you very much for coming in today. And a reminder that you can find out more about the trial at 4GWirelessBroadbandTrial.co.uk. That's it for another Tech Weekly. Many thanks to Ben Room, Keith Stewart, and Charles Arthur. Next week, we'll be on the floor with Keith from E3. Godspeed, Godspeed. Come back for the best analysis of the announcements then. The producer this week was Scott Cawley. I'm Alex Krotowski, and we will be back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.